Hello, and welcome to Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson. I'm your host, Robert Washburn. This program is coming to you from the Williams Treaty Territory and Northumberland 89.7 FM. For the next 30 minutes, we will bring you important stories and issues facing Indigenous and non-Indigenous people living here in Northumberland County and across the country. It is your chance to become better informed, more engaged, and empowered as we all move together on the path to reconciliation. So join us for the next step on this journey. I'm with Tainar Simpson, Chief of the Alderville First Nations. Here we are once again for our monthly conversation. How are you doing, Tainar?
Pretty good, Robert. It's great to be here, as always.
We're going to start off by talking about something called Bill C-53. It deals with Métis rights. Can you start off by telling us about this rather controversial piece of legislation before the House of Commons? I understand it's about to receive a third reading. What is the bill as you understand it?
Well, we are not sure exactly why the government took this approach to Bill C-53. We know that there was a Supreme Court decision that recognized Métis rights to be on par with First Nations rights. So I think that the government decided to take that as meaning that Métis should have the same rights as First Nations people. So this is where we don't quite see eye to eye. Bill C-53 intends to give treaty rights, harvesting rights, land rights, and basically inherent rights to Métis people on par with the First Nations rights. So what we see that as is basically overstepping what Métis rights should be and putting them right in the realm of butting up against our rights, therefore opening the door to confrontations and legal battles about hunting and treating rights that are already on, say, like the Williams Treaty territory and other territory of First Nations. So we know that there weren't any historic Métis settlements in the area. In fact, Métis people didn't exist until colonization of the Europeans. So they didn't, they weren't Indigenous to Canada per se, as they didn't exist as a people until post-contact. So that's, to us, that's where the heart of the issue is. And the other second issue on that is Métis is self-identifying. Anyone can identify as Métis. And in this case, that means that theoretically all any Canadian would be able to self-identify as Métis, and then all people would have inherent Indigenous rights. And when everyone has the same Indigenous rights, then really no one has Indigenous rights.
There's a lot in there, what you said, and I'd like to sort of pick it apart a little bit more and maybe understand all the subtleties in there. You say that there was a Supreme Court decision that mentioned that Métis people have equal rights. And then you spoke and you said, but they should not have the same rights. What's the difference between those two ideas, the same and equal?
Well, First Nations rights come from our specific history with the Crown. We had peace and friendship treaties in the 1600s, 1700s. We formalized agreements in the numbered treaties with the Crown that recognized our sovereignty over our lands, that we were pre-existing nations. The Royal Proclamation of 1763 said that you have to treat with the First Nations people in order to gain access to their lands, and it has to be mutually agreed to. So these agreements weren't signed with the Métis. It's arguable that Métis didn't exist at the time. So to come and say these rights that First Nations have fought for centuries are now going to be given to Métis people, it doesn't ring true. It's disingenuous from our standpoint.
Can you give us a little bit of history about the founding of the Métis people?
Well, if we were talking about historic Métis, we would be talking about the Red River Métis, the Machif in Manitoba. That would be Louis Riel's people, Gabriel Dumont. They had their own culture. They brought in both worlds. They walked both Indigenous and settler. And they had a good mix of culture, and As an anthropologist, I understand that they did have their distinct society. They had a distinct culture that was truly what they would call as Métis, and they tried to create their own homeland unsuccessfully. That's what the rebellion was, and I believe it was the 1870s. So basically, those are what the Métis are. But then, when you come back to the Constitution Act of I believe it was 1981 or 1982. The Métis were included in Section 32. It's recognized First Nations, Métis, and Inuit. And at that point, Métis had never been recognized in such a way. And across the country, overnight, Métis organizations popped up to try to get those recognized rights in the new constitution. So ever since the new Constitution Act, the Métis have existed as a national voice and people across the lands, but they don't have the historical connection to what the Métis originally were in Manitoba.
Even more fundamental than that is that the fact that the Métis are people who were a result of intermarriage between colonizers and indigenous people. And so they, in some cases, French, Irish, Scottish, etc. And they are the children of those people who then identify now as Métis. Am I correct in that?
That's correct. So there was a lot of it was mostly French. They were the original European stock for the Métis people. So they were voyageurs, trappers, hunters, fishers, explorers, and they relied upon indigenous know-how to survive off the land. So often you would have them working together. They were a lot of times they were allied. So when you get couples mixing, you built up enough of a population that they became their own a distinct society.
Now, the concerns about this, obviously the Métis people have their version of why they want these rights and why they think they're entitled to them. Is it really all Métis that the Assembly of First Nations has concerns about, or are there specific groups?
It's definitely specific groups. This act, it's recognizing Métis governments in Alberta, Ontario, and Saskatchewan. So as you noticed, Manitoba wasn't listed in there. So let's talk about Ontario specifically. We know that there weren't any historic Métis settlements. Although the Métis Nation of Ontario is now claiming that there were, we know this not to be true. We also have the Manitoba Métis disavowing the Ontario Métis, agreeing with us, saying that no, there weren't any specific Métis settlements in Ontario. So they're trying to basically push a historical narrative that's doesn't ring true, and obviously this bill benefits them, so they would want to support it. And ultimately, it's creating a division between Métis and First Nation people that is artificial. We have always got along with the Métis. We've always wanted the best for them. So for the government to come in and do something like this to pit us against each other, because that's exactly what's going to happen. It's going to our bag of rights is going to be dipped into by them, and they're going to be taking our rights, and we're going to be sharing things that weren't meant to be shared that way. So it's really just another example of the federal government pitting Indigenous people against each other. But so specifically right now, Bill C-53 is only Alberta, Ontario, Saskatchewan, but we believe the door would be open to the rest of Canada. This is once the door is open for something like this, it doesn't get closed, it just opens further.
When you make these arguments, you're making them in the context of a Supreme Court decision. If the courts have said that this is true, then why can't you just accept what the courts have said and let the government set its policy?
Well, I think the Supreme Court said that Métis people should be recognized in the same way that First Nations are under the Indian Act, which to us, that's where we disagree. We believe Métis should have distinct Métis rights, a distinct Métis relationship with the federal government. And to say that that equals a First Nation and mirrors the First Nation model, that doesn't make sense because they have a different history, they're different people. So we believe that they should have tried to say, hey, what are Métis people? What makes Métis distinct? Let's start from there, not that start from First Nations and say that that's Métis. So we believe that they went backwards. In a lot of ways, it was sort of the easy way out for them. You can tell that they don't really have a grasp. The federal government doesn't really have a grasp of the issues. And this was just written up by some bureaucrats and politicians that really don't have an understanding of how the history and the legal context of these issues came about.
The Métis people are asking for the same rights for self-governance and other rights like authority concerning their internal governance, citizenship, elections, government operations, child and family services. That all seems pretty reasonable. Why such a fuss?
Well, I think it'd be great if it was, if they were, if it was distinctly a Métis model, then I believe that that's what it would be. But these Métis rights, harvesting rights, and treaty rights, we don't believe that Métis have treaty rights just because they weren't pre-existing nations here. So how can you have a nation-to-nation relationship with a group that's not a nation and it wasn't here before? But these areas are already in First Nation treaty territory. So to give hunting and harvesting rights that's already within a treaty territory of First Nation means you're taking rights away from the First Nations that have those rights and long, hard fought rights there.
This is a very complex problem. And I'm sure that there are Indigenous people who have relationships today that involve intermarriage, and there are children that have come out of that, and generations have developed over time within the Indigenous community. How is that different from the Métis?
Well, I think that when you get back to the non-Manitoba Métis, there isn't a distinct society. There isn't a certain way that they do things, whereas the original Métis, the Machif, they had their own styles of dance, their own styles of music. They even had their own language. These are all things that make a culture and a society. Now here, you're getting anyone that self-identifies, anyone who believes they have any Indigenous blood in them can now self-identify as Métis. They're from across the board. They're not from any specific distinct society. And to bunch them all together as these are Métis with the same rights as these original Machif people, it's we really think that what should be happening is all of our First Nations population that have lost their status through the second generation cutoff rule and that might now be claiming Métis because they no longer have their First Nations and status, we feel that you should get rid of the second generation cutoff rule, make them back into First Nations people. So instead of our enfranchised members becoming Métis, we would rather see them come back as First Nations people. So you have people in the Métis organizations that really should be First Nations. And to us, that's the other major issue. So with the second generation cutoff rule, we are losing First Nations members and they're going to the Métis. We feel that, again, that that's disingenuous, that they seem to be granting these rights to people that they already took the rights from. And they're doing it in the backwards way.
That was going to be my next question, was to how does Alderville handle this intermarriage?
Well, the main thing that see there is Bill C-31 that gave status back, granted status back to women who married non-Indigenous men and lost their status. They were able to get their status back. But at the same time, the government snuck in this second generation cutoff rule. So Alderville, as a small First Nation, we are most affected. We have been losing members that should have stayed members. We don't have a big enough population to, you know, marry within to keep our numbers up. So you have a lot of marrying out. A lot of the larger First Nations don't have that problem because there's just more people there. So we've done studies that show there aren't going to be First Nations members born in Alderville in the coming decades. Then we would eventually cease to be a First Nation. And effectively, the government's idea to get rid of us as an Indigenous people starts to happen. They have never lost sight of the fact that the focus is to get rid of Indians in Canada. That was their statement from the very beginning. We were called the Indian problem. And that's exactly what the Indian Act was about. And as long as you have the Indian Act, we feel that their focus is to eventually get rid of us as a people.
How do you see this being resolved now that the legislation's in third reading? There's been a lot of talk about it recently and more pressure building on both sides. How do you resolve this, one, so that everybody can walk away feeling there's a middle ground?
Well, there's an easy solution, and that's to remove the bill from consideration. They tried to sneak it through with not much fanfare. And at first I was like, oh, Bill C-53 sounds great. They're giving Métis rights. So, but then the more I looked at it, the more I realized, hey, this is done totally wrong. What should have been done is they should have brought all of the stakeholders to the table, had negotiations. What are First Nations concerns? What are Métis concerns? What do Métis rights look like? And have a big discussion, and not just a few people in one room somewhere deciding how it's going to be. And if that had been the case, and if we were at the table, we would be a lot more comfortable with the onus and how they were going to proceed. So the next steps really is, hopefully, if they don't take it off the table, is to try to kill the bill in the Senate. So there's less senators, and they're more generally more independent than the party line. So we feel that a vigorous look at the bill in the Senate will potentially stop the bill at that point. So we have been canvassing senators that we know to really take a look at this and just not accept it because they were told to.
That wraps up our conversation about Bill C-53 and Métis rights. Please stay tuned to hear more conversations towards reconciliation with Tainar Simpson. This is Northumberland 89.7 FM, your local source for news and information. We'll be right back. Welcome back. I hope you're enjoying our chat today. I'm Robert Washburn, and I'm here with Tainar Simpson, the chief of Alderville First Nations. We are so glad you're joining us. I'd like to talk to you today about former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney, who recently passed away. Can you tell me a bit about him and his relationship with Indigenous people?
I'm not sure if I'm going against the grain here, but I actually believe that Prime Minister Mulroney was a positive force for First Nations. I feel he was one of the prime ministers that didn't necessarily toe a party line, that just always tried to do what he thought was in the best interest of Canada. We know that he's mostly remembered for GST and NAFTA. At the time, they were very unpopular decisions, but they've actually ended up working out for Canada. The NAFTA, we know, has made Canada's economy stronger. The GST was one of the things that brought down the debt, especially the Liberal governments. Later, they were able to say that they reduced the debt, but mostly in part to the GST that came in from Mulroney. Now, I think from an Indigenous lens, Mulroney would be most recognized for the Meech Lake Accord and then afterwards the Charlottetown Accord, which recognized Aboriginal peoples in Canada as having inherent rights and an inherent right of self-government. Now we know that the Charlottetown Accord wasn't approved. It was declined in the referendum. And another thing that Mulroney did was he, after the Charlottetown Accord fell apart, he commissioned the Royal Commission on Aboriginal People in 1991, basically because he wanted to get to the bottom of the issues of what's going on with First Nations in Canada. Why are they so upset? What can we do to make it better? And the RCAP was the most intensive study ever done on Indigenous people and our condition in the country. And it just made a whole whack of recommendations on how to improve First Nations relations and quality of life in Canada.
We could take a travel back in time and go back to the Charlottetown Accord. Had that gone through, how different do you think it would be for Indigenous people today?
Well, I think it would have been a sea change of how the federal government related with Canada. It was basically affirming that we had a nation-to-nation right, that we had pre-existing governments that needed to be recognized. And I think self-government would have gotten a big kick in the pants and really gone down the way it should have. Now, over the decades since, we've sort of gotten there, but it was in a haphazard way. Whereas had the Charlottetown Accord been approved, I think that we'd be maybe 20 years more advanced than we are now in terms of First Nations rights in Canada.
I'd like to also talk about the commission that you mentioned in 1991. How is it the same or different than the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, which really advanced so much the Indigenous people's rights and our understanding of what is taken has taken place?
Well, the TRC report and the RCAP report are very similar beasts. Now, I think that if the original Royal Commission on Aboriginal Peoples had been taken seriously, we wouldn't have needed the TRC report. Now, I remember I was first starting to work for the federal government in 1996 when the Royal Commission report on Aboriginal people came out. And to me, this was amazing. I read it. I thought, wow, I can't believe that Canada's recognized all this. It's incredible. And at the time, the federal government's response, which was a Liberal government at the time, they said, oh, we take this seriously. And they started this gathering strength program that was to respond to RCAP. And what it amounted to basically was a checkbox on everything and said, does this meet gathering strength? And you just, they'll do a little click. I know this because I was in the government at the time. And to them, that was the response. The RCAP was generally shelved. There came a time when you couldn't find the RCAP online anymore. So the internet was generally new. I originally saw it, but then you really couldn't find it. They weren't making mass copies and handing them out. They didn't like all of the progressive recommendations that the RCAP made. So then when the TRC report came out 20 years later, they were basically rehashing a lot of the same things that the RCAP had done. RCAP had made all these recommendations that were never done. And then the TRC was like, hey, these are recommendations. And they really paralleled what had been done in the RCAP report. So it was just a way that, reaffirming that what was in the RCAP was correct. And you have another Liberal government saying, we do respect it and we want to make the changes, but really there hasn't been that much done.
How would you have described the public mood towards Indigenous rights when Mulroney was in office as compared to the public mood now about Indigenous rights?
There was a big difference. I'm going to have to say that the Canadian public as a whole wasn't prepared for reconciliation the way they are now. We know that the general public was in denial about the plight of the First Nations people in Canada. They weren't prepared to honor the treaties on a nation-to-nation basis. I personally experienced a lot of racism every time I brought the issues up. It gets back to where they wanted us to be that romantic vision, historical vision, where we weren't a modern day people. We were a traditional old people that their ways had died out. So I think there was a lot of that going on at the time. You had the Oka crisis going on, and which really divided a lot of the population. So I think even though there were strong opinions, the opinions weren't based on historical fact or depth of knowledge of the issues.
You mentioned earlier that you were in Ottawa at the time working within government. Did you ever get an opportunity to meet Mr. Mulroney?
No, I did not. So he had already moved on by then. So I guess at the time that I knew that it was a Brian Mulroney issue with the RCAP. And I really appreciated that. And again, I actually admired the Prime Minister. I didn't think that all these things that people hated him for were necessarily the right reasons to be upset with somebody. So it shows that you, even if you have a good idea, it doesn't mean anything unless you follow through on it. So it was a good idea in 1996. It's a good idea now. So I think that Mulroney kind of represents someone, a day of politics that don't exist anymore. Everything is so heated, everything is so controversial and partisan that once you're in one side, one party, you absolutely have to toe that hard line. Otherwise, you're not going to become a representative of that party, which is sad to see. You don't see principled people anymore that just want to do the right thing for the sake of it.
How would you describe Brian Mulroney's legacy in the eyes of Indigenous people?
Well, it's hard to say. I think there's a lot of strong opinions. Some people might think that I shouldn't be saying that he was good for Indigenous people. Everyone's got their own personal opinions. Mine are based on, from what I know, from the history and the research that I have. Some people might really hate the GST and say he was horrible for that. So everyone has to come to their own conclusions, and these are just my own personal conclusions on the man and his legacy. And I couldn't really speak for what someone else is going to think about him.
I've really enjoyed this conversation about former Prime Minister Brian Mulroney. Have you got some stuff for us about what's going on in Alderville in the upcoming weeks?
Okay, yes, we have quite an interesting slate of events coming up. Now, in no particular order, we can announce that we have a dart league that's starting every Tuesday, starting on March 12th, and that's going to be at the Alderville Community Center from 6 to 9. So if you're interested in darts, from when you hear this, every Tuesday, come on down. It'll be a fun time. So the offices, Alderville offices and the daycare are going to be closed March 29th and 31st for the Easter weekend. But you probably already would have known that. Now, some updates that we've been on. We have an election code, that is going to be brought to the, community, and we're hoping to get that ratified so we can, patriate our election process. We've made some progress on getting representative policing in Alderville. We were at a conference last week in Rama where we feel like we took some steps for ensuring that we're going to get some good policing soon. We have a number of housing rental units up. So if you're looking for a rental, then make sure you get your application in. We've got a two-bedroom duplex available, two-bedroom detached residence, and we are going to be opening soon our two, three-bedroom triplex rentals. So if you're interested in that, please let us know. On March 30th, we're going to have our annual Easter egg hunt at 10 a.m. Meet at the Health and Social Services building. It's a really fun event. My girls loved it, but they're a bit too old for it now. But who knows? Maybe I can convince them to come out. And now a big one is we have a retiring member, employee. Brenda Bennett is retiring after I don't want to say how many years, but it might age her. But yes, she's been working tirelessly for decades for Alderville. She's been a fantastic addition to the team. So we just want to give a big shout out to Brenda, and there will be a nice retirement party for her. And May 4th, our final announcement, we're having our first annual Lands Fest brought to you by our Lands and Estate Department. So this is going to be an annual event that we're all going to partake in and increase our knowledge and know-how on what the Lands Department is doing. And there's also a logo contest. If you're a kid or a kid at heart, please feel free to submit your design, and that will be the new logo for the Lands Department. And there's also a small prize for the winning logo. And that's it.
Busy as always.
You sure are.
I want to thank Alderville First Nations Chief Tainar Simpson for talking to me today. I want to thank you for joining our conversation, and I hope you enjoyed this time to learn more about what's going on, the stories and issues facing Indigenous people living in Northumberland and elsewhere. That's all for this week. I'm Robert Washburn. Join us again next time for Conversations Towards Reconciliation with Tainar Simpson.